This is Neijing Now, prioritizing well-being. Neijing is the vitality that shields us from disease. Neijing Now, demystifying medicine, cultivating resilience, empowering host resistance, prioritizing primary prevention. I'm Dr. Jayashree Chander. I welcome you to another short clip exploring Neijing Now. I'm speaking with Andy Couturier. He's a writer and a writing teacher from Santa Cruz, California. Andy, welcome to Neijing Now.
I'm really glad to be here. Thank you.
Andy, thank you for writing A Different Kind of Luxury. I'm inspired by the people in the book. I want to go meet the people in the book. I was so sad when I came to the end of Ito-san's chapter to find he's already passed. I really wanted to meet him. I'd like you to share with our listeners what this book is about.
It's about time and how you use it, what it is to be alive as a human being, how some people have found a really great life providing for their own needs, most of them with their own hands, and how that whole trance that many of us are in, like we're going to make a lot of money so that I can have a big house and then I'll be happy, makes a lot of people miserable. And here are these people who are living a really sustainable way of life. It's not a lifestyle, but it's a way of life that gives them lots of time to have long, slow conversations, eat delicious food, walk in nature, and connect with their own spirituality. They've been doing it for 20 or 30 or sometimes 40 years. What is it that we're doing now that we could do 5 years from now, 50 years from now, 100 years from now? It's about living a meaningful life.
So basically, you went to Japan. You decided to profile 11 of your friends.
Well, they became friends in the process of writing the book, but mostly I think of them as teachers and people that I really admire. Some of them are artists, some of them are musicians, potters, writers, but they're not traditional native elders. Many of them grew up in small cities or in large cities. Some of them were middle class, some of them were working class. One woman was a daughter of a doctor, and they went to India and Nepal and found some teachings and a way of living that seemed to them more reasonable and really touched in on this sort of big question. What is it mean to be a human being?
That is a big question. And it is remarkable that each of these 11 people seems to have spent a fair amount of time in India or Nepal and in the Himalayas.
I mean, that was so surprising to me. So we didn't go to Japan to meet them. My sweetheart and I, we went in 1989 and we were just working and trying to get some organic food. And we met these people who were living out in old Japanese farmhouses, terraced rice paddies. When we were invited there, we got off and we had this amazing 7-course Indian meal in not only just Japan, but rural Japan, like way, way out in the mountains. And here were these Asian people who were connecting with the wellsprings of Buddhist thought and Hindu philosophy, which through the history of Japan, they've been cut off from. Reconnecting with handwork, Gandhi's teaching, self-reliance, the humility. It was such a surprise to me to find this transnational or international culture and awareness, not in the big cities in Japan, not in New York, but actually in rural Japan. So that was very remarkable. But also, India is an important place.
India, my mom says everything comes from India.
And everything comes from China. So it's a tricky debate, but yeah.
These people traveled to India, but not as the typical tourists. They went to learn something from India.
Some of them went to learn about pottery and sculpture. Some of them about hand dyeing cloth. Some of them went just to be there. One guy, Murata, is a flute player. You know, I asked many of them, you know, what did you do in India? And some of them told me, oh, I studied this. I studied that. I didn't study anything. I was like, well, what did you do? Well, it's like slow. As if slow is an activity. I said, but, you know, you woke up and he's like, went outside and I talked with the Indians. Oh, so you studied Hindi. He said, no, I didn't study anything. I just talked. And what did you do after lunch? He said, oh, I took a nap. And I was like, this is not your standard workaholic Japan. But Murata now grows rice. Sometimes it's a lot of hard labor in the hot sun. But because he has deeply internalized that slowness, he's able to do that. He's not in a hurry. If it takes a long time to do it, then he doesn't have a lot of financial obligations. Him and his wife, and he has a son, live on $3,500 a year. And you have to think that this is Japan, where things are a lot more expensive than they are here in the United States. He also plays 6 or 7 songs on his big bamboo flute, all of them over 800 years old. Doesn't make up any new ones. He says they have centuries of refinement. He can practice 6 or 7 or 8 hours a day because he learned slow in India.
That's satisfaction. That's contentment. Murata-san's trip is the journey I always wanted to take in India. And yet, because I carry some credentials and et cetera, et cetera, I've always felt this pressure. I need to quote unquote do something and quote unquote be productive. And yet what I find in the people that you've described, their lives are actually incredibly productive and incredibly satisfying. And yet there's no striving for status or fame or acquisitions or acknowledgement.
Yeah, there's another guy, his name is Koichi Yamashita, and he's got a PhD in Hindu philosophy, and his dissertation was on a yogic view of Buddhism, and he's lectured at international conferences, and yet he makes his living growing rice, and when he needs a little bit of extra money, he tutors after school. For a couple of years, he was doing some maintenance work in an organic tea plantation, and I was thinking, Yamashita-san, this is a long way from teaching at Shantiniketan University. And he's like, yeah, it's not so bad. You know, I get to be outside. No one's looking after me. And he's explaining his work, which is pulling weeds out of the tea plants. And I said, so in a non-organic tea plantation, they deal with this weed with pesticides. He's like, exactly right. And then he like squats down underneath the plant. It's a hot day. And he's like pulling the weeds out. Why do you have to squat? And he's like, well, if I don't pull it out from underneath, it'll grow back up. If it gets mixed in with the tea, it makes the tea taste terrible. So if I'm drinking organic tea somewhere in the world, somewhere in Japan, someone's doing this squat labor. And he looks at me and he laughs and he's like, it's the grapes of wrath. I had a lot of these ideas about slowness and not status driving, but how far dialed back all these people were, the way I was challenged about, well, he's a university professor. He shouldn't have to do that. But that was pure classism on my part. The humility there has been tremendous teaching for me.
Every person in this book is inspiring to me. So you said that the Japanese have been cut off from the culture of India or what India has to offer. Can you explain that?
Sure. This is just a historical fact of Japan. There's been a number of times where they've become a closed country. So between 1600, when the first Portuguese missionaries came, they saw what was happening to other countries being colonized. The shogun said, no one can come in and no one can come out. And that lasted for 250 years.
Whoa.
If you were a sailor and you got blown off course and then you returned to Japan, you would be killed. If you were a Westerner and you went to Japan, you would be killed. Another person I read about, Masanori Oe, he was one of the first people after World War II who was not a businessman or a government official to get a passport. And that was 1965. So between 1945 and 1965, ordinary Japanese people were not allowed to leave. So reconnecting and finding what India has to offer is pretty important.
Interesting. Do you have any parts of the book that are like your favorite parts that you want to share?
So this is in chapter 8. This guy's name is Gufu Watanabe. He is a potter. Gufu was born very poor and he never got on that train to become wealthy, even though these people were growing up right at the time where they could have gotten very, very rich with the rest of Japan. But time is wealth. If you have time poverty, then you're really impoverished. There were ways to advance economically, but they would lose something much more precious to them, their freedom.
Absolutely. I find my time to be more valuable to me than anything on the planet. I have to work really hard in some ways to protect my time. There's this societal river that doesn't understand if time is more important to you than money.
Right. Well, that's a good lead-in to the passage I'd like to read to you. Gufu and Atsuko live in a small village called Kamikatsu. They have access to propane for cooking, but they do most of their cooking and heating with kindling. It's a very forested area, so there's a lumber mill in town and there's scraps. Those scraps are just burned by the lumber mill. Gufu saw it going to waste and said, well, we'll take them. But the thing is there's a lot of rain in this village, so all the wood's wet. So one day I was visiting them, and it's a sunny day, and they're turning over each individual block of firewood to dry it. And I'm thinking, that's a little tedious. I had internalized an industrialized way of thinking. Isn't there a one-switch solution for that? So here's the passage. So Gufu, this is me, But I'm just wondering, all that time you take doing so many small tasks, isn't that frustrating to you? No, not really. I mean, for example, turning over the tiny little blocks of damp firewood, isn't it tedious? No, I think that's just what this life is. He says this with absolute firmness. But most people would rather be reading a book or something, not turning over firewood to dry it. There's nothing to do about that, he answers. I've given up on that kind of thinking. So you simply think there's nothing to do about it, and that solves the problem? Sometimes it does. But I try to think that way. It might be better if I didn't have to turn over the firewood. But to me, there's no question of which one is more important. I think it's all equally important. So do you still read Heidegger a lot? Yes, quite a bit. But isn't reading Heidegger more interesting? Yeah, there is that. His voice trails off slightly. But it's just what I said. That's what this kind of life is. As he's speaking, I think I detect just the smallest note of sadness. Like maybe he's a bit disappointed in me continuing to ask him this question. His voice is lowered. But then he repeats himself, his resolve returning. This way of living is a human being's way to live. That's what it is.
Exactly. Each of us makes those choices. Wouldn't you rather be having your breakfast at home rather than grabbing it on the go on your way to the office to get there at 8 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah. Well, this is not a how-to book, but I do notice in my personal life that there are some people who have found that fortitude to say, I'm just not doing that. But a lot of people who don't, they say, well, who's going to do the work? I said, well, if there's more work to do than there are people at your office, then they haven't hired enough people. Everyone's afraid of getting fired. But the question that I'd like to ask your listeners is, why does that become more important than, say, having time with your kids? How does this become more important to you than your writing, your artwork, just your simple time sitting on a rock on a hillside and watching the wind play through the trees? We have to each strengthen our own determination. Looking at gravestones is a good way to do that. Do you want to look back and think, well, at least that coworker 30 years ago didn't think I was lazy?
Well, I think it's very complex. People end up with mortgages or the rents are so high and the wages don't match. You need to put in the hours to keep yourself financially solvent and sheltered. One of the things I found about the people in the book, they're not as dependent on cash.
That's a very important thing about the book. People think economics is about money. It's like saying a carburetor is the reason for a vacation. I just thought that up.
I'm trying to understand that.
Well, I mean, a carburetor's in a car, and the car gets you to the place maybe you want to go on a vacation, but you're like focusing entirely on the carburetor, which is the money, right? The money may be part of getting you what you need, but there may be other ways to get what you need. When you make the decision to eat out or buy a big house.
Or these days, buy any house.
I used to live in a two-bedroom apartment. We moved to a one-bedroom apartment. Then we moved to a studio. Each time I've gotten happier, which is nice, you know, because I wrote the book saying that that would be true. But we sort of get this idea, we have to have blank, blank, and blank, and then all of a sudden we're stuck. These people happen to live very, very far out. They can rent for, say, $100 a month, a beautiful old farmhouse, but they may not be able to go see movies. Well, what about Netflix? Well, they don't have an internet connection. They don't use money to entertain themselves. They grow a lot of their own food. Many of them make what they need with their own hands. I mean, our humanity is connected with our hands, which is what Gandhi was trying to tell us, is that actually handwork can be tremendously meaningful.
Not can be, is.
Is, yes, yeah.
I recently had a friend come over. That was the first time she came to my house. She took a look at my apartment and she said, is that all you have here? Gosh, you should work more as a doctor.
You're a great example. I mean, you went through and got a MD and then you chose to live simply. And you're doing this podcast series as a gift. I think you probably have a lot of wisdom to share with people about how to make that change.
I didn't make a change. I just continued. When you're a student, you live simply. And I said, well, I can just continue to live like this because I like it. And I like my time. I need more time than I need more money.
How did you make that decision? I mean, everyone else around you decided, whoa, bingo. I put in 10 years of my life getting this and I went incredibly into debt. Now I'm going to get the Porsche. How did you not end up like that?
All through my medical training, what I craved was time. I craved a good night's sleep. I craved time to dance, to read fiction, to write, to just play and be relaxed. When I had the opportunity to sustain myself, at a level of comfort that I continue to feel comfortable with, why would I trade away the time that I've always wanted? And I firmly believe that standard of living is not the same thing as quality of life. I guess when I came back from one of my long sojourns to India, I just decided that I wanted to have a standard of living that pretty much everyone on the planet could have, and it would be sustainable for planet Earth. Now, I don't think I've achieved that. I would have to simplify even further.
Yeah. In chapter 3, it's about Atsuko Watanabe. She was at that moment just graduating from college, and she had this insight. If I start living a life of money now, it'll be very difficult to go back to a life of no money later. So she actually made that decision to not jump on that train. I mean, you don't have to jump on that train. Now, I saw a term called lifestyle creep, and I like it. This person was talking about they moved into an apartment that had an automatic dishwashing machine. Then when they moved again, they felt like, we cannot move into an apartment that does not have a dishwasher. That's happening on a lot of different levels.
Atsuko actually says it beautifully. She says, convenience just makes your life go faster.
Yeah, tremendous insight. It's like, oh, isn't, you know, just being able to send an email, that's going to take a lot less time than getting out a piece of paper, writing a letter. Oops, it's not right. I got to rewrite the letter. I've got to fold it. I got to put an envelope. I got to put a stamp on it. You know, that takes a lot more time.
But then you have to write to a lot less people.
I've got 30 emails to write before I go to bed tonight.
One of the things that concerns me, and I'm speaking as a physician now who knows something about occupational and environmental health, many of the people in the book are using wood as their cooking and heating fuel. We know that using biomass materials is actually bad for the environment and very bad for the humans who are close to the fire.
It's a concern I have. There's a lot of wood there. There is no petroleum. It all has to be imported. And I would imagine they would say, our goal is not to live the maximum amount of time.
It's not about necessarily even extending your life, but it is a quality of life issue when you have respiratory issues or respiratory infections.
And yeah, I should say one more thing about the wood is, if you just take, say, a standard home that has a fireplace in America, they might burn through, say, half a cord or three quarters of a cord in a single winter. Most of the people in this book are using little tiny pieces of kindling about an inch or 2 inch wide and 4 inches long. It's not that much, but we do have an impact on the environment, 7 billion people on the planet.
We have deforestation and all the stuff that we need to consider. I just learned that in San Francisco, they're not allowing new homes to have wood-burning fireplaces anymore. But there are ways to use biomass fuels in a way that minimizes the exposure to the smoke. We'll do another episode on that.
Well, I would like to learn that from you. You know, these are not perfect people, and I don't write it as a piece of hard-hitting journalism.
Well, that's not the intention of the book. The book is actually very inspiring. The people are very inspiring. The conviction that they carry about what is important to them is really inspiring to me.
And to me, too.
Is there anything else you'd like to say about the book or about the people? Or is there another passage you'd like to share?
This is a piece of writing by Masanori Oe. He's a writer. He's published a lot of books. He was actually the first person to translate Krishnamurti into Japanese, Ramana Maharshi. He also translated the Tibetan sage Milarepa, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, as well as Hopi elders' words, Australian Aboriginal elders. This is a passage of Masanori's own work. I honestly feel that in the midst of our free market competition society, the world is getting more and more violent. Market principles and market rationality preach that the strong must devour the weak. We are being asked if each of us will be able to resist being at the mercy of marketplace rationality, and whether we might be able to see the life that is inside our food. If we don't, we will buy things just because they are cheap. Similarly, we farmers will grow corn simply because we are given money to grow it. I think in this generation, we are being asked to go beyond this kind of thinking, and we have to if we really want this earth to be sustainable.
Exactly. Well said. Thank you for sharing that.
It really is about gifting. Economists say that early economies were based on barter. Is actually not true. The anthropological research from thousands of societies that do not have coinage or currency shows that it was all about gifting. People gave to each other all the time. So we would all feel in some ways indebted to each other emotionally.
As we should.
Yes, as we should. We're all alive by means of each other. That's a quote from Masanori Oe as well.
We're all alive because of each other. Beautiful. There's one other person that just struck me. He and his wife translated something and bound each copy by hand.
You're asking about Masanori Oe, and it was the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And Masanori is the only person in the book who's lived in the West. And he actually came over to New York City in 1965 and studied with Timothy Leary and got involved in the psychedelic movement, made films in his psychedelic experiences, had some transcendent experiences. And when he, some years later, was in Nepal, he came upon the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and it explained his experience exactly. So he went back to Japan and he wanted to share it with other Japanese people. So they did a translation.
He and his partner,
Wakako. She's a calligrapher and a puppet carver and a farmer and a farming mentor. They did a translation of this book and they couldn't find a publisher. They found a printer and they paid the printer and they did 1,000 copies of this book, and they did it in a huge format, 3 feet long by 1 foot wide, the red bound cloth books that many people who've lived in India are familiar with. And they bound it with some of their friends together by sewing it into 1,000 hand-bound copies. And it became so important. All these publishers came and said, well, would you publish with us? And the other was, would you publish with us? So that's this experience of just believing in something enough.
When I read that story, I just said, see, that's the thing. If you really believe in what you're doing, you just do it and everything else will be fine.
Like your radio program.
Like everything I do. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you, Andy, and a really amazing experience to read your book.
Well, thank you very much.
Andy Couturier, author of A Different Kind of Luxury, teaches writing through the opening at theopening.org. I'm Dr. Jayashree Chander, creator of Neijing Now, a podcast about prioritizing well-being, on the web at neijingnow.org. Neijing Now is independent and entirely listener-supported. If you enjoyed the clip, please share it with your friends. Like us on Facebook and donate generously. Your support is essential to keeping Neijing Now alive.